Welcome to Practical Christian Living.
Is there not a cause? And that should be a rally cry for us. Is there a cause? Is there a reason for us to take a risk? Are we called to do something that makes a difference in the lives of people, even throughout eternity? Is there not a cause?
There is so much for us to learn from the account of David facing the giant Goliath. David's heart was right before his God, and because of that, he knew God was with him and would be his strength in any battle he faced, even against a giant. With 1 Samuel 17:1 through 55 and our study, Overcoming the Challenges of Your Life, here's Robert Furrow, pastor of Calvary Tucson.
We are continuing our study in the life of David. This is our third study. We come now to one of the best known passages out of the Old Testament, David and Goliath, in a study we've called Facing Your Giants or Overcoming the Challenges in Your Life. All of us will face giants, probably several times in our lives. Certainly we face challenges. Maybe you're even facing a challenge right now that brings fear into your life. You don't know what's going to happen. And this may help you as we see how David faced this giant with his flesh. He could do nothing to overcome him, but by putting his faith and trust in God, he was able to overcome this giant. The Bible tells us that God is working with us as his children were brought into his family. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all of your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. It will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones." When God directs our paths, and even though this is such a common verse, I wanted to read that up front because of the part of it that says, it will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. We're strengthened when we are led by him and go down the paths that he wants us to go down. Hebrews 13, 5 and 6 is interesting too. As far as God working with us, it says, let your conduct be without covetousness. In other words, don't be caught up in the love of money. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can men do to me? God is with us as we endeavor to live our lives for him. God has not given us, the Bible says, a spirit of fear, but of a sound mind. And we don't want to be overcome by the fear of what's coming, but trust him, even with the difficult, hard circumstances, even when you go down roads that you never planned to go down, that you would trust the Lord in that. David certainly didn't think when he went out to the battlefield that day that he was going to be facing one of the biggest men to ever live, but he did indeed. The faith of a shepherd boy becomes an example of the kind of faith we are to have to live our lives boldly and courageously for Christ, even when we are making sacrifices, even when we face things that may bring difficulties into our lives. We're giving things up to live for Christ. God will move. Now let's take a look at our text. We see right away in verse 1 of chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, it says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle." The Philistines were a group of people that had moved to the area of Israel from the Aegean Sea up in the area of Europe. They were sea-bearing people, and they'd come down to the coast of what today is Gaza. When you look at what's taking place in the Gaza Strip, that's where the Philistines were. You would expand it a little bit on both sides, come back in a little bit, and that was the region of the Philistines. The word Philistines is somewhat connected with Palestinians, the name Palestinians, but they are not the descendants of the Philistines. And I hear people say this, and it's just not true. And also, the connection with the word is still a little bit hazy. I know when you look it up, it talks about it, but when you go and you try to look up the scholarly work and see the footnotes on it, it's a little bit hard to find. But the Philistines were Europeans that came from the Aegean Sea. They were sea-bearing people. And so their armor, their weapons were more sophisticated than what Israel's were because they were able to go around through their boats to the different different areas. They fought different people. They took technologies from the other people for themselves. Akron, Ashkelon, Gath, all Gaza are four of the cities. There's five of the cities that are there. Archaeology has discovered what the Philistines were like. Their pottery definitely comes from the area of Greece, radically different than the pottery of the Middle East. And their armor, the things that they wore, was radically different. So they set up in battle array against Israel. It says that they were gathered at Sakkah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Sakkah and Azekah. In Ephes, Demon and Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. Now, if you've been to Israel, you've probably been to the valley of Elah. I've been on this battlefield several times. And when you think we're going to read about the army of Israel being on one side and the Philistines being on another side, and they're both up on hills, don't think of a smaller battlefield. Think of a larger one. We know exactly where these are at. We know where the Philistines were camped. We know where Israel was camped. We know where Goliath came out. And it's about a mile from each other. And the valley in the middle slopes down slowly and comes to a creek bed that runs through the middle of it. That's where David and Goliath fought. So it's a larger area as you take a look at it. Now, it says, and Saul and his men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side. Now, when you think of a mountain, we think of our mountains. You've got to think of mountains in a little different term when you're in this region. It's more like hills. I think the King James Bible uses the word hills. I would call them a hill if I were out hunting in that area. I wouldn't call them a mountain. I would call a mountain something different. So we just got to get a little bit different idea in our head for this battlefield. And Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, we're told that he's from the city of Gath. There's some interesting archaeological finds in Gath. For one thing, when they uncovered the area back down to the time of David and Goliath, they found that there were some larger structures in there. There were bigger dwelling places, which is just interesting. I'm not saying that they found Goliath's home, maybe. Goliath and his five brothers, maybe. But there was a bigger area that was there. They also found a piece of pottery with the name Goliath on it. Now, again, we don't know that it belonged to Goliath, but it's just interesting that they find the city of Gath, and within the city of Gath, on pottery, they find the name Goliath. Not only that, they found some of the brass armor that they wore. Their armor was unique. It was like scales. They took pieces of bronze or brass and they put them on top of each other, connecting them together like scales to protect them from the blows. They wore them over their legs and they wore them over their body. And they found some of them there. In fact, we actually have a picture of them that they'll be able to put up for you. There it is. That's the armor that they found. You can see how they would make scales, and they would overlap this way too, not just down rows, but everything else had rotted away when they found this, and only the armor remained. This particular armor was not from Gath. I couldn't find a picture of the armor from Gath, but this is like what they found in the actual city of Gath. Now, it says that Goliath was 6 cubits and a span. So that is about 9.5 feet, which we don't know of anyone who existed that was 9.5 feet tall. There are some questions about the large skeletons that people find, whether or not they are authentic. So just kind of remember that when you're watching a YouTube video on giant bones that were found or something. There are some questions about them. The tallest man that we know that has lived on record is Robert Wadlow, and he was 8 feet, 11 inches, which is not far from 9.5 feet. It's close. And we have a picture of him as well as he's standing next to an average-sized man, and you can see how tall he looks compared to average people. The people today, like Andre the Giant or others, that have something called giantism, it is a genetic problem that they don't stop growing, and they reach certain heights. They also have problems. Even though Andre the Giant was a professional wrestler and incredibly agile and athletic, he still had problems because of the giantism. most who have this disease would not be able to do what Andre the Giant did. I think Andre was 7 feet 5 inches tall with giantism. The tallest man that we know that did not have giantism, that just was a normal man who just grew really big, was the picture that we had up here from the 1880s. And this is Angus Mescal. All right. And Angus is 7 feet 9 inches tall. He's standing next to a 6'5" guy. So that just lets you know, once you start getting, what is that, a little over a foot difference? Once you start getting a little bit bigger, someone becomes massively larger than another person. The biggest person that I ever stood by was Shaquille O'Neal. He'd come to the U of A to play. We went down to see him, and I had my son David with me, who was a basketball player, and we went down on the floor to walk by him. And again, I was amazed once I got up next to him how big he was. Being out there on the floor with all the other people that are big as well, and then getting up next to them, you saw what their size was. Now, all of this would be increased because the average size of someone living 1,000 years before Christ, which is the time of David, was 5'3". That was the average size of a man. The average size of a man today is 5'9". And so that would be increased and the whole scale of the body. So facing someone who was 9 feet 6 inches in his day. Now, some manuscripts that use a shorter number, so there is some debate as to what number should be used in the different manuscripts that are out there. Either way, significantly larger, and especially if he was somewhat athletic, like Andre the Giant was, who could have just killed people easily. Now, verse 5, it says, he had a bronze helmet on his head and was armed with a coat of mail. We saw what that coat of mail would have looked like. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, which is 125 pounds. He had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now, the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, which I don't know if any of us are familiar with, but it must be big. And his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, which is about 15 pounds. So the spearhead, a normal spearhead is going to weigh a few ounces. To have one that is 15 pounds would be amazing. And it goes on to say, and the shield bearer went before him. So not only that, he had somebody carrying a shield for them. If on the battlefield somebody shot arrows at you or somebody threw spears at you, you could duck behind your shield. After the barrage, you could step back out and you could get back into the battle again. So they brought shield bearers with them onto the battlefield. It says, then he stood and he cried out to the armies of Israel. And he said to them, why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel today. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all of Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now, the Bible says that Saul was head and shoulders taller than anyone else in Israel. So the closest one to be able to fight Goliath would have been Saul. And Saul was like, I ain't doing that. And so everybody was fearful. We're going to see in a moment that he incentivized anyone who would go out and fight against him. Now, David was the son of that Ephraimite of Bethlehem, Judah, or Judea, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons. And the man was old, advanced in years. In the days of Saul, the 3 oldest sons, Jesse, had gone out to follow Saul to the battlefield. And it gives the names of them here. We go down to verse 16. And the Philistines drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. So for 40 days in a row, morning and evening, the Philistine had got out and presented himself and did set out these challenges. Now, that means 80, right? So there's 80 times that he's marched away from his army. His army's behind him, but he's marched away from his army. He's gotten into the sound of Saul and his army, and he's given them this challenge. And they're fearful. They're afraid. Nobody wants to face him. So in verse 17, then Jesse said to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephah, that's about a bushel, of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brother at the camp and carry these 10 cheeses to the captains of their thousands. So a little bit like take care of my son. Here's some cheese. Take care of my sons. And see how your brothers fare and bring back news of them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and took the things as he went to Jesse, as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp where the army was going out to fight and shouting for battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hands of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion. So as he's talking with his brothers, he goes and he sees his three brothers. He begins to have a conversation with them. And all of a sudden now, he hears Goliath. Now, no doubt that David had heard of this taking place. This is not the first thing that he heard of it. But now he sees them. And here he's called the champion. So he's done this before. And this was something they would do in their day where two men would get together and fight it out representatives from their nation. Maybe that's the way we should do war today as well. But he was a champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. So the armies were behind him. So they come down their side of the mountain and they come across it. And he spoke according to the same words. So what we just heard, defying the armies of Israel, send me out a man. So David heard them, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So David's looking out at the giant. He turns back around to see the guys he's talking to, and they're gone. Everybody fled. They were like, I'm out. I think that nobody wanted to get chosen by Saul. That Saul's like, this is the 80th time that he's come out here now. If 81st, you go out and fight him. Everybody just goes. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled and were dreadfully afraid. So they're overcome by fear. So the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Did you notice the term there, come up? He'd done this 80 times. He'd come down their side where they were camped, come down into the valley, gotten to the middle part, and now was coming up. He was so brazen at this point that no one was going to come out and fight him. After you go out and challenge people 80 times and no one steps up, you're pretty confident. And he gets up on their side. Have you seen this man that has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills the king will, now we're going to learn three ways in which Saul incentivized someone to go fight him. The king would enrich with great riches. First of all, you'd be rich. We'll give him his daughter. Now we're going to meet his daughter a little bit later on. And Charles Swindoll says there's a reason he wanted to give his daughter away. Then later on made a reference to the three things, being rich, freed from taxes, and plagued with Saul's daughter. That's the term that he used to speak of her. We'll see that there's some problems with her. But this would marry you into the family of the king, potentially allowing you to become king. And we know that David has already been anointed as king. So this is part of what God's plan was. And give his father's house exemption from the taxes in Israel. And that would be the best of the lot right there for us today. Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, what shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away this reproach from Israel? He's saying, look, you're going to take away the reproach from Israel and then you get these things? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine? He's like, I'm more interested in stopping this reproach from this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God. David's got a whole new look at it. He's like, these are the armies of the living God. And who is this guy to defy it? And the people answered him in this manner, saying, so shall it be done for the man who kills him. So he's asking and he's getting the same answer. Now, David is the youngest of seven brothers. His three brothers are there. Now, Eliab, the oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David. So Eliab gets angry, not at the Philistine who is defying the armies of God, of the living God, but instead at his brother who wants to go out and do something for it. We can end up battling the wrong people. We can get upset and get caught by fighting against other believers, other Christians who may believe things differently than we do. People make a whole ministry out of pointing out where people are wrong rather than talking about what we should be doing. And one of the things that we're supposed to be doing is loving one another and encouraging one another. And his brother becomes angry against David. And he said, why do you come down here? Why did you come down here? And whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? And that's an insult, right? He didn't say, who'd you leave those sheep with? But those few sheep. You're just a shepherd boy and you only got a few sheep anyway. I know your pride and the insolence of your heart. Isn't that interesting? David was chosen for his heart. His brother was rejected because of his heart. And then his brother challenges him for what he has. Oftentimes, we can see our own sin clearly on other people. This is hypocrisy. And when we do it, it's hypocrisy. And it's something that Jesus told us to stay away from. Do not be like the scribes and Pharisees who were hypocrites. You certainly don't want to, you don't want to become overcritical of anyone, but you certainly don't want to become overcritical with someone who's doing something that you know you've got going on in your own heart. And this sometimes can happen. I remember a few years ago when Jimmy Swaggart had found out that another pastor had some kind of a sexual indiscretion. And Jimmy Swaggart used to talk a lot about coming to church in shorty pants. This is back in the 70s or late 60s. So I'm pretty sure shorty pants are shorts. That's what I'm pretty sure they are. But he would be preaching. He'd be like, you're coming to church wearing your shorty pants. And that's kind of a look into his soul because he had a sexual indiscretion that eventually, well, he didn't get removed from his church, but eventually people stopped going to his church because of the massive hypocrisy that was in his life. And you remember his tears of crawling out and asking God to forgive him while he's at the pulpit. And I don't know, a little bit showy, but we want to watch our own hearts and see what's happening there and not project it onto other people. And projecting our sin is a real thing. It really happens. So he says, I know the pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. And David said to him, what have I done now? Which I love. That's so much like a little brother. What have I done now? That's a great answer. Then he says, is there not a cause? And that should be a rally cry for us. Is there a cause? Is there a reason for us to take a risk? Are we called to do something that makes a difference in the lives of people, even throughout eternity? Is there not a cause? I have a little sign of this in my office. Right now, because we put some studio in there, it's kind of laying on the floor. But is there not a cause? It's great to have that thought and to remember it. It's one of the great things that we can bring from this chapter. We have a cause. There is a reason for us to be right with God. There is a reason for us to battle sin and get it out of our lives. There is a reason for us to live in front of other people so that they can see Christ in us, the hope of glory. Because there is a cause. There is something that we're involved in.
Thank you so much for joining us for Practical Christian Living with Robert Furrow, pastor of Calvary Tucson. We pray that wherever you're listening from, the study of God's Word is encouraging you and strengthening your walk with Christ. If you'd like to hear more of Robert Furrow's teachings, visit calvarytucson.com. Producing this program would not happen without the support and generosity of listeners like you. If you'd like to partner with us financially, and Practical Christian Living Radio and TV has blessed you, please visit pclaz.org. That's pclaz.org, where you can make a secure one-time donation or sign on to become a monthly partner on a reoccurring basis. We'd love for you to join us at one of our two campuses in Tucson. Our West Campus is located at 5170 South Julian Drive, and our East Campus is located at 8711 East Speedway. East Campus service times are Saturday evenings at 6 p.m. and Sundays at 10 a.m. Our West Campus meets Sunday mornings at 8:45 a.m. and 11:15 a.m. Our midweek service times are Wednesday, 6 p.m. at our East Campus and 7:15 p.m. at our West Campus. You can also listen live to our Saturday, 6 p.m., Sunday morning, 10 a.m., and Wednesday evening, 6 p.m. services right here on Reach Radio Tucson at 106.7 FM, 96.1 FM HD4, 690 AM, streaming at reach.radio or via our Reach Radio app on your Android or iPhone. If you have recently accepted Jesus into your life and you have questions about salvation, we'd love to help guide you in your journey. Email us at saved@calvarytucson.com. Don't forget to follow us on social media, Instagram at Calvary Tucson or Facebook at Calvary Chapel Tucson. Our local listeners can watch Practical Christian Living Sunday mornings at 8:30 on KEGA 9 TV. Thank you for joining us for Practical Christian Living, a ministry of Calvary Tucson, where we are reaching for Jesus, connecting with people, and walking in truth.
Calvary Tucson has developed a discipleship school with you in mind. Reach College of Ministry is for adults of all ages who want a deeper relationship with Jesus, a stronger grasp of the Bible, and practical insight into fulfilling your God-given calling. Earn your certificate in theology in as little as 1 year, or enroll in individual courses for personal growth. Attend courses online or in person at Calvary Tucson's East Campus. Visit thereachcollege.org today to learn more and start this exciting journey.